26 chapters across the world, and this movement would not be possible. This kind of excitement and the generation of energy would not be possible without a brilliant, courageous, bold, and innovative team of people.
Well, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to continue the conversation after the show and post it online at democracynow.org, the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter. That does it for our broadcast. You can get a copy of today's show by going to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Laura Gattas Diener and Juan Carlos Davila and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Thanks to Elizabeth Press, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is WHFR, Dearborn. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is July the 24th, 2015. I'm your host, Jay Koronek. This is Public Affairs and Alternative Views for Dearborn and the local areas. Yeah, and we're live from Henry Ford College. It is still one of those closed days at the campus for classes, but registration is still going ahead for fall semester. Our Welcome Center is open today. I think their hours are until 4 or 4:30, a little bit less in the afternoon on Fridays, but they're here. And if you have any questions or concerns, of course, you can always go to the website, too, if you don't want to do a visit to the campus, WHFR. Is right here in the Student Center, but again, the Student Center is locked today. But we're here, and we would like to let you know you can go to hfcc.edu for any information about admissions or registration for the fall semester, which starts, by the way, August 27th. Today's July 24th. Oh my gosh. OMG. That's only... Let's see, July has 31 days. So that's 34 days away. And so classes are filling up fast at different sections, and there's still time to get the classes you might need, either to complete a degree or a certificate in a particular area, or whether it's just career enhancement, or maybe just life enrichment. All kinds of classes here at Henry Ford College, and definitely, time is for the summer is almost over, and it's time to get focused on what you're going to do with yourself in the fall, and making changes in a good direction, we hope. Well, let's get on with the stories of the day. Didn't have too much time to organize the order of the stories today. Do I ever? Well, sometimes I do. I have more. I was fixing a computer here at the station. But anyway, the big news, I think, is that we have filled the vacant Dearborn Board of Education seat. It was filled by appointment of the current Board of Education. And here's the story. It was put on the Press and Guide Monday, July 20th. Local attorney Fadwa Alawi will be the newest trustee for Dearborn Public Schools. Her last name is Alawieh. Hope I pronounced that correctly. The school board picked Alawi to fill a vacancy created when former board president Amy Scholes moved out of the district and resigned at the end of June. The six remaining trustees initially each presented their top candidates, which resulted in three names, but ultimately they voted 5-1 for Alawi. Trustee Mary Petchlikoff opposed the appointment. Alawi has a law degree from Wayne State University and a bachelor's from University of Michigan Dearborn. She works in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, is a board member with both the Government Bar Association and the Islamic Center of America, and is active in several other organizations. At Monday's special meeting, each trustee was initially asked to pick their top choice from the 18 applicants who interviewed for the appointment last Wednesday and Thursday. Alawi received the nod from trustees Mary Lane, Maryam Bazzi, and Michael Mead. Trustees Petchlikoff and Joe Guido suggested former 18-year board member Pamela Adams, and current board president Roxanne McDonald put forward one-term trustee Hussein Berry. And my apologies to Roxanne McDonald, whose first name I could not remember last week, and the Press and Guide left it out of their story. I won't say they forgot, but they left it out of the story. That's where it shook down. Here's a little background on it. As Katie Hetrick reports to the Press and Guide, Bazzi said she liked Alawi because of the depth and breadth of her involvement in the community. A recommendation from Sholas helped a lot, too. So this was a candidate, one of 18, that actually had the recommendation of the former board member. And Bazzi said, I very much value her recommendation because I know she understands the board. And there's that phrase that comes up again. It came up last week by several people. We want someone that understands the board. Talk about the Board of Education, not the board students or the board teachers or the board administrators. No, but then that's a pun with the word B-O-R-E-D, of course. I don't understand this phrase about understanding the board. What's to understand about the board? They get an agenda, they talk about it, and they vote. What's to understand about the Board of Education? Now, this candidate that they chose has a lot of credentials from a variety of areas, but does she understand the board? Well, Amy Sholas says she understands the board. What does it take to understand the board? Because that's what gets you appointed. Don't speak out of turn. Don't speak against anything that the president is saying. Don't raise a question at the last minute that'll drag on past, bedtime for the majority of the board. I'm being very facetious but direct here. It's come up in several articles, and board members have said, we don't want someone that doesn't understand the board. Wouldn't you rather have someone that understands education? How it works? What its purposes are? What is this magic knowledge that the board has that most other people don't have? I'd love to know. And of course, if I ask a question like that to any of the board members, they're not going to tell me, because it's only something the board knows. And why would they share it? Because if they share it, then everybody's going to know. And then everybody at the next chance for appointment is going to be able to be appointed. It's just very strange that the same words come up and there's no clue as to what that means. I haven't researched it much, but it seems to me you get the agenda, you talk about it either before or after the meetings or during the meetings, and you vote. Huh? What is there to understand? You have to have a budget by state law, although some school districts forget about that, that is not in the red. Okay? That's an understanding. But I think that's pretty simple to understand. What is this all about? I don't know, but we wish the new member, Fadwa Alawi, and that's A-L-A-W-I-E, we wish her good success with championing the cause of education for our children in this community. And, of course, you realize, folks, that when you're appointed to the Board of Education, you're also appointed to the Henry Ford College Board of Trustees. You have a separate meeting each month, and you go to that, and so we hope that she gets to know Henry Ford College really well. And we certainly invite her on the program if she wants to come by and tell me what it is she knows about the board that other candidates didn't know what her understanding is. But I'm all for her because it is a tough job and very underpaid and yet very, very important. Now, Petrikov, who didn't vote for the final choice, and let's see, what did they say here? Mary Lane says she voted for Alawi because she was quick on her feet. That's a quote, not how fast she walked, and came across as articulate, professional, and confident in her interview. Petrikov, McDonald, and Guido all felt the board would be best served by a former trustee, because who would understand the board better than a former trustee? Petrikov worried the board was essentially endorsing a candidate for next November's election with very little knowledge to go on. Adams specifically said that she would not run for election next year. And so that was Petlikoff's feeling. I don't feel I'm endorsing someone for the future electorate to hang their hat on because they just heard a little bit about them and read a resume. It's not like a campaign where you might get a lot more information about the person. And it's not, of course, the vote of the people. You've heard about those things. People get together and cast their vote, and the majority gets their way. It's called an election, folks. Yes, I know you know that, but a lot of people don't vote, so I'm just mentioning that for you to pass along to them, that there are such things. And I understand Mary Petrikov's point of view on this. And she said, finally, we are only six people. We don't speak for the thousands in the community. McDonald says she opted for Barry because of her concerns over Adams' ongoing health issues. Barry is also very active in the community and represented the board often at functions when he was a trustee. And we're looking down the article, which is an extensive article. You should read it in the Dearborn Press and Guide. It was in their sort of lead story on page one just 2 days ago on the 22nd. And Katie Hetrick always has very, very complete information, a lot of background information you might want to know about. By the way, Alawi graduated from Fordson in 2003. Let's see, 12 years ago, theoretically, if she graduated when she was 18, she's 30 now. In the last few years, she helped campaign for the district's smart bond referendum and Henry Ford College's millage question. So I guess she has been involved with the college in that regard in the past and has background. Understanding. Okay. Other items that came up at the regular board meeting at the college, the board approved money for a balanced scoreboard institute. The company will provide a strategic planning and management system to help provide a broader view of performance. $166,000+. A lot more data, the president of the company said, to make policies with. Data could include not only college-wide graduation and retention rates, but figures down to the division and even to individual instructors. Measures will relate back to the college's strategic goals and also provide insight into what is driving these results. I thought we had that information already. We do here at the college. I don't understand what they need $167,000 spent on. Because I see that information all the time. It's internal, but, you know. Trustees heard a report on orientation at the college. Things are going along well for the fall semester. And physical therapist assistant program also highlighted the meeting. The program only admits 28 students each year, plus some from the Henry Ford Early College Program, a joint endeavor of the district college and Henry Ford Health System. But these physical therapist assistants generally upon graduation earn $45,000 to $55,000 a year, and physical therapy professionals have the second highest job satisfaction nationally, following only, okay, what do you think is the occupation in which the people are most happy with their job? If the number two is physical therapist, and of course you can ask the question why, but well, according to this, and who knows where this comes from, but highest job satisfaction nationally is with the clergy. Our ministers, our priests are the happiest of any in any job category in the U.S. Well, certainly not teachers. There's nothing that has happened for teachers that has been good in the last, 10 or 20 years at least. Taking away pensions, taking away pay, increasing class size, taking away money for hardware, software, textbooks even. Well, you know, my daughter in Southfield Public Schools has to bring paper for the class. The school doesn't have any money to buy paper. And most of our students don't come with paper, I guess. The department, this PTA, the Physical Therapist Assistant Program, is also leading the way to record lessons so students can review them later or even during class. Jobs, I assume that's on video, maybe audio. Job placement is 100%. Licensure pass rate is 98%. Wow, now that I said that, you're really going to run to your computers and try to enroll for this fall. That's Physical Therapist Assistant Program. You'll be happy and well-paid. Oh, my goodness. But they only take 28 a year. So you know what I think? They take the best qualified 28. So that could certainly help the graduation rate. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? And rightly so. Why wouldn't you take the best qualified? It makes your program look better in the long run after it's being tested or when they're trying to get placed. But good for them. It's a needed program. I don't think it's for every. If everyone was a physical therapist, what would the world be like? Or turn that around. If everyone was a member of the clergy, what would the world be like? Hopefully, they're all clergy of the same religion, or they're going to get into fistfights with each other, I think, because that's what we're doing anyway, supposedly for religious reasons, in many places of the world. And so, I don't know. But if the clergy don't have to fight in wars, I think that would be one reason that they could be a very happy occupation. No. Okay. Well, thank you very much. They are hoping, of course, Henry Ford College and others, that and this story came about a couple weeks ago, didn't mention it directly, that the state of Michigan will expand its permission to many community colleges to offer more four-year degrees. And the big one is nursing. And Henry Ford College has one of the biggest programs to graduate nurses, get them into jobs in the state, I think. Maybe not more than MSU, but still, we graduate a lot at this level. And so does, I think, Schoolcraft, too. And so both Schoolcraft and Henry Ford College would like to see the state of Michigan allow us to offer four-year degrees. And as a final point here about Physical Therapist Assistant Program, they hope that that will be allowed for them, too, because four-year degree is good in that field, too. Mm-hmm. So that's the story about our Board of Trustees and the new board member, Fadwa Alawi. Alawieh. Let's see here. Let's get to a pre-recorded story. You probably heard this last night if you're really a news junkie, but the background is excellent. We've mentioned this too. It is a major story because why? Dearborn is in Wayne County. Here from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, based in Ann Arbor, is their radio story, the audio story that they did just 14 hours ago about Wayne County being in a state of emergency.
Governor Snyder has made it official. Wayne County is in a state of financial emergency. County Executive Warren Evans had asked for that declaration. The county faces a projected budget deficit of $171 million by 2019. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House has some advice for Wayne County's commissioners and its executive. Learn from Detroit. Daniel, what brought Wayne County to this point?
Oh, Lord. Lots of things. A lot of really poor financial management, number one. They increased since 2007, increased their general fund expenditures by about $50 million. And meanwhile, property tax revenue was dropping like a stone to roughly $150 million. I mean, that doesn't work in anybody's budget, clearly not in the government's. Badly managed and mismanaged their pension fund that in 2004 was close to fully funded and only had, I think, less than a $50 million in outstanding liabilities. And now it's about 44% funded, and it's almost $1 billion in outstanding liabilities. The botched jail project is well known. We talked about it on your air, and, mm-hmm. and other people have talked about it and written about it. And that continues to be a millstone around the county's neck and around the taxpayers. I think where we are now, though, is we have a county executive who's really trying to get his arms around this, and I think is winning an awful lot of credit from people, Republican and Democrat, for being very realistic and really pushing the right issues and trying to show the discipline that I think you saw in Detroit under emergency manager Kevin Orr and now under Mayor Mike Duggan. Problem is he's got to deal with a county commission that I think still has not really come to terms with what's facing them. And it's going to be very interesting in the next few weeks as they have to make some decisions and move forward.
Absolutely. And these, as you say in your piece today, very, very tough decisions lie ahead.
Oh, absolutely. Look, they have to choose between one of four options under the state law, Public Act 436. They can go to mediation to try and have a mediator look at this and try and propose solutions. They could get a consent agreement, which is essentially a deal with the state treasury, says we will do X, Y, and Z. And then the other big one is, of course, Chapter 9 bankruptcy. I think everybody thinks that where we're headed right now is a consent agreement, and that the county commission officially, but really the commission and the county executive, will agree to a set of terms with the treasury that says, and a timetable that they will do certain things.
And we remember that happened with Detroit, and it was worthless.
Exactly. They pretty much wasted 11 months doing nothing and dragging their feet, and then ultimately they ended up in Chapter 9 after an emergency manager was appointed. I think what the gambit here is by Warren Evans particularly, and the commission, is to avoid the appointment of an emergency manager, and of course bankruptcy, because they lose control politically. It's not popular, and they've seen this movie before about what can happen in that situation in terms of lost control. So I think what they're really going to be pushing for is this consent agreement, but that means they're going to actually have to deliver. And I think the governor is moving with quite a bit of dispatch here. They've done this before. The state apparatus is familiar with this process now. They can move very quickly and do the analysis they need to do, and so down the road we go.
What help did Detroit get that Wayne County can pretty much not count on, and why?
Well, you know, the grand bargain, which we've talked about many times over the last couple of years, I think is the most obvious example. And I don't think you're going to see foundations and other kinds of private sector players stepping forward to help the county. And I also don't think you're going to see a Republican legislature, which I think by most accounts is probably more conservative than the one that actually financed the grand bargain, stepping forward to help the county. And clearly some of the business interests that were flocking to downtown and continue to flock to downtown as a response to Dan Gilbert's investments and what he's doing in the city, a lot of those things aren't necessarily going to happen. I don't see any evidence that that's likely to happen. So this is going to be more of a tough love kind of push by the county. And frankly, they're doing it at a time that is a lot harder to make the case. You know, Detroit went through the recession. It got badly beaten up in the recession. It got badly wounded through the automotive bankruptcies. You know, you had the conviction of Kwame Kilpatrick, the mayor. I mean, I think a lot of people knew that things were broken. They were clearly broken in the city. Now we've got a situation where General Motors announced their numbers today, one of the best quarters they've ever had. I mean, it just blew the doors off. So this is all happening in a time where things are pretty much looking up around here. So it's a lot harder to make the case to say we are in real, real trouble, I think, when the macro environment is so much better. And so that's really going to be the challenge of this consent agreement, is basically agreeing to some things, and which then means that you have to execute them, and they're not going to be popular with employees, they're not going to be popular with public unions, and they're not going to be popular with some of the constituents. I do think there's a lot of other constituents that really want to see change in county government, and this may be the lever that we're going to get to see some of that.
And I'm wondering, as you talk about all of this, things that are going to have to be done that are difficult, what do you think the human toll might be? And for that, I'm thinking, if I'm a county retiree, am I watching this with great alarm? If I'm a current county worker, what do you see?
Well, there's a couple of things that I think are realities here. You can't unvest vested pensions. You can change accruals. You can do things going forward, but you can't take away necessarily. Outside of bankruptcy is a very, very important distinction. Outside of bankruptcy, you can't necessarily take that stuff away. And I don't think that's likely to happen now. Could there be impact on health care plans? Sure. Could there be impact on county employment as the county looks at potential services that they say, you know, maybe we don't need to do this anymore as a county service. You know, maybe certain cities can start doing some of these kinds of things. So I think they're going to be looking at operations. So, yeah, I think that's where you're likely to see things happen. I think less likely is any impact on taxpayers. So they're just going to have to come to terms with the situation they're in. Bankruptcy is much more difficult to apply to counties under both federal bankruptcy law and under the state emergency manager law from people I've talked to. I know emergency manager Kevin Orr has looked at this and has studied the situation and has come to the conclusion that, you know, Chapter 9 is a much neater kind of tool to use for a city than it is for a county where you have multiple elected officers who are constitutionally elected. You have a clerk, you've got a prosecutor, you've got the county executive, you've got, I think it's five in Wayne County. And so it makes it a lot harder to implement a bankruptcy and to execute one than it does where you have a single chief executive like a mayor in a city.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes looking ahead for Wayne County. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Michigan Radio for sharing that with, in fact, the entire world. It's on their website, michiganradio.org. It is going to be a big issue that we are going to follow because there definitely will be consequences for the people of Dearborn since we're part of Wayne County. So it looks like consent decree, as he said, was going to go on. I question, of course, from the reporter analyst that was interviewed there, poor financial management, that the whole thing was mismanaged for years, for a decade. Of course, they said that finally about the city of Detroit, too. How can this go on for this long? What do we blame, Fecano or someone before him? How can this head-in-the-sand kind of approach happen? Gary Warrenchuk kind of implied at times, since he's the spokesperson for the commission. They appoint him to be their chair, if you will. Can't remember the exact title, but something like that. And, you know, in fact, he and Evans have disagreed on certain matters, like the special assessment this summer to pay for money that the court said had to be paid by the county. So we all got that already in our water bills for our tax bills for coming up for fall, I think it is. Summer tax bills, they call it, whatever it is. Anyway, I saw it. I know I'm going to get hit with it. And it's about, in my case, about $75. I talked to someone else, and they looked at their bill, and they said it was about $100 for them. And that's a special one-time assessment to help out Wayne County because we're all in Wayne County, and we use a lot of services of Wayne County. So I would say bottom line, first of all, is, who do you blame here? Got to blame somebody. I mean, you almost feel that if there's complete gridlock, mismanagement, incompetency, you want to get rid of all of them, don't you? And by the way, most of them are Democrats. It's just the way it works out in Wayne County because there's more Democrats and they don't really know who they're voting for. They just vote a straight party ticket and so the Democrats get in. Gary Warrenchuk knows that. That's why he changed from Republican to Democrat years ago so that he could easily get elected to the commission because they're not term limited. Yeah. All right. That brings me to a commentary. You're listening, by the way, to the new WHFR Journal for Friday, July 24th, 2015. My name is Jay Koronek. And we're doing things a little bit differently, of course, here. That's why we're making waves. That's our slogan. Here is Jack Lessenberry's editorial from only an hour ago, by the way, also posted on MichiganRadio.com, about term limits bad for Michigan politics. That's what we have now is term limits. I just mentioned we don't have term limits on people like the Wayne County Commission. Well, listen up to Jack Lessenberry here and see what you think.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. If you want a practical illustration of why term limits are a bad idea, Here's a good one. Yesterday, Senator Debbie Stabenow managed to engineer a deal to save perhaps $100 million in federal blight funds set aside to help Michigan cities tear down ruined buildings. A few years ago, the federal government established something called the Hardest Hit Fund, money set aside during the Great Recession to help cities deal with blight and foreclosure problems. Urban experts will tell you that it's critically important in saving neighborhoods to demolish vacant, crumbling eyesore buildings as soon as possible. Older Michigan cities, especially Detroit, are filled with such buildings, which often become breeding grounds for crime. Michigan has applied for, used, and spent more than $40 million in recent years to demolish well over 3,000 homes. But Republicans won control of both houses of Congress last fall, and many of them see this as something the federal government shouldn't be doing. Some have accused cities of wasting this money, and they're all set to zero out the hardest hit fund. Instead, they wanted to put the remaining funds toward infrastructure to help fund the 6-year transportation bill Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell needs to pass by the end of the month. This would have been devastating to Detroit and other cities' efforts to fight blight. There would have been bigger problems, too. Michigan cities have spent millions to tear down such structures and, in many cases, are waiting to be reimbursed out of federal funds. Who would pay if the program suddenly ended? Republicans had the votes to pass it, but Stabenow, who's been in the Senate for nearly 15 years now, knows a parliamentary trick or two. She could have placed a hold on the bill that would have held it up for 10 days. That might have caused a much longer delay, since the House of Representatives is scheduled to go on vacation for all of August. But something else is going on here, too. Personal relationships. McConnell and Stabenow have worked together for years. They may be political opponents, but they know each other. They've each been in the majority and the minority. Neither's leaving the Senate anytime soon. They also know it's entirely possible that Democrats could win back control next year, and that failing to work together now could have long-term consequences. So, they worked out a deal. The blight funds were saved, the transportation bill will speedily pass, and the missing funds will be found somewhere else. This might not have happened if all the players were inexperienced, term-limited, knew they wouldn't be working together for very long. This is one of the unfortunate differences between Washington and the even more dysfunctional world of Lansing. By the way, I criticized Senator Stabenow 2 weeks ago for opposing repeal of a country of origin labeling law for meat that has threatened us with retaliatory tariffs from Canada. Now it appears she may have found a face-saving compromise that would allow, but not require, American farmers to label their meat product of the U.S. Governing, as opposed to politics, is largely about two things, experience and compromise, which is what adults do every day.
From MichiganRadio.org, it is a key news source that I look at frequently because they are a non-commercial media operation. That means they don't care about advertising and being nice to those advertisers or treating them gently or not talking about them at all if something bad has happened with their company or their service. You can always trust, WHFR is a non-commercial media. Well, we do the best we can. And if we get things wrong, we apologize or we straighten it out soon after that, certainly. Here's another commentary, though, from Jack Lessenberry, a little different topic that he issued just a couple days ago.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Here's something we seldom realize, but which incessantly fascinates me. You know that for some time, microbreweries have been all the rage. But in fact, we live in a world full of microcultures, which we like to think are more or less interwoven into whatever passes for mainstream culture. Increasingly, however, there seems to be less and less of a common thread. During my professional career, I've come to learn that people who work in news operations, especially editors and managers, are often curiously blind to this. If you're putting together a regular news broadcast or a newspaper or a report of some sort, you're necessarily trying to impose a manageable order on the world. Editors don't think that way at all. They think they're engaged in the business of finding out the most important, interesting, and relevant news, distilling it into a manageable package, and delivering it to people so that they can make sense of things. Newspaper editors and news directors tend to be extremely well-informed and well-rounded people with a broad grasp of the sweep of events, except that what they miss is that most people don't see the world that way. The other night I was at a birthday dinner in an odd restaurant called the Mule Foot Gastropub in a rural area of Michigan's Thumb. There was a table in back where a group of men were having a long, intense discussion with faces that reminded me of Hollywood portrayals of the American High Command during the attack on Pearl Harbor. They were clearly discussing something very important, but which the news seemed to be very bad. Being curious, I managed to slowly walk by their table on the way to the room set aside for those who, like me, drink large amounts of coffee. Turned out they were talking about the complete collapse of the Detroit Tigers bullpen and what should be done about it. My guess is that they were only dimly aware of most of what journalists tend to think are the major issues of the day, other than perhaps our crumbling roads. They could, however, just as easily have been talking about breeding beagles or quilting. There's nothing wrong with that. There's far more to life than worrying about who's going to be nominated for president next year. However, what I worry about is this. 30 years ago, most of us got a coherent daily picture of reality from a newspaper and from nightly national and local news broadcasts. Nearly all shared a similar view of what news was. That may have been a flawed and too narrow view, too heavily shaped by middle-aged white men. But you could assume people had similar sets of common knowledge. You cannot assume that anymore. Only a small minority regularly reads a daily paper or watches nightly news broadcasts. Almost no one, under 40, does. That could be part of the reason why we find it so hard to get a consensus on solving any issue. Any successful society needs common assumptions and, to an extent, what I call common intellectual furniture. We've lost some of that due to the decline of mainstream media. Finding a way to get it back may be more essential than we know.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst.
And I'm Jay Koronek back at the WHFR studio here. that's a very insightful sort of a telecom professor, which Jack Lessenberry is down at Wayne State University, kind of insight. And it is a problem. many journalists actually go to college, and college, with a four-year degree anyway, actually forces you to learn a lot of things about a lot of different topics, whether it's history or political science itself or geography, hard sciences, as they call them, chemistry, physics, perhaps, mathematics, literature, poetry, all that good stuff in the humanities. And that's a balance. At least for years, it's been thought of, it's a good balance. Of course, the general public, and especially those, I even discovered this when I went to I think it was a 10-year reunion of my college graduating class. Now, I had immediately gone from college, my four-year school, to a master's degree, and after that year as a master's, I get a job teaching full-time in college, and I've been doing that for the last 45-some years. Well, but just 10 years in, I went to my reunion, and these people had gotten jobs, one place or the other, and they didn't know everything that I knew. They were not keeping up. And in those days, we're talking about decades ago in my 10-year reunion, folks, of my going to college. Then most people read a newspaper every day. Somehow these people didn't, or they didn't care. And, of course, there wasn't internet, and there wasn't people tweeting news and Facebook postings and so on. You say, well, it was awfully hard to know what's going on. Well, even now it's hard to know what's going on because most of the tweeting and posting is from people that really don't know what's going on, and their opinions are unverifiable. I was going to say something else, but unverifiable, okay? They may be great. They may not be. You don't know. You read them, though, and you think, well, maybe because they posted it or tweeted it, it must be something that's valid. No. It doesn't have to be. It just means they've got a lot of guts, courage, or ego to put it out there. I certainly don't know everything about everything. But I do because I do the show. I do read the papers, both the Dearborn Times Herald, the Dearborn Press and Guide, and now I have to read the Downriver News Herald because even though it's published by the Press and Guide has chosen not to put a lot of stories that are about my surrounding area in their newspaper. So I'm wondering, why should I spend $102 a year for home delivery of the Press and Guide when they don't give me stories about Allen Park or Lincoln Park or Trenton so much anymore, if at all. Not a comprehensive paper. And so I'm just saying, I read them. I feel I have to share ideas with you, but I have to go to michiganradio.org. I have to go to mlive.com and many other internet sources that I can trust, usually ones that are non-commercial media, but professional organizations. Oh, the Michigan Center, they do Bridge Magazine, which is, I don't think there's ever been a physical copy of Bridge Magazine, but that's what they call it. They do great journalism statewide and locally. So there are places, and I got to go to a lot more places to find this information. It's a lot harder today to stay up on the spectrum of the news. Well, that's my problem anyway. And your problem is listening to the show. So I'm going to continue with stories that you haven't heard before. Last week we mentioned, and I made some comments about the statue, and you heard comments from other people too, an opinion last week also, about what to do with the Orville Hubbard statue here in Dearborn. Gretchen Ackerman, who has been, I think, an opinion or a person or a columnist in the Dearborn papers for years, and has been part of several community organizations throughout the years, volunteer for many different purposes. This is her opinion, and it gives you a little background for those that never knew Mayor Orville Hubbard and just think, oh, he was a racist. Well, yeah, he was, but, basically he was a segregationist, and that's racism, I know. But listen to her opinion. It's in the Downriver News Herald as well as on pressandguide.com, and it's in the papers, too. She says to the editor, "It is time to speak out for our former mayor, Orville L. Hubbard, who served our great city of Dearborn relentlessly for 36 years. In fact, no other mayor has gone down in history of serving their community as long as well as Hubbard did. Hubbard once interviewed me from my position as research writer for the city of Dearborn, working directly for Alex Pilch, director of research and information. I will never forget Mayor Hubbard for his loyalty and dedication to the people of Dearborn. It was back in the 1950s when West Dearborn was being developed. He maintained high standards for the neighborhoods. The homes, parks, and playgrounds all follow a plan for commendable neighborhoods. As we grew into a very respectable town attracting new residents, we became very proud of our subdivisions. All of the department heads working under Mayor Hubbard abided by his strict rules, and we admired his leadership. Mayor Hubbard became known for his riddles, such as, sweep your doorstep clean." Is that a riddle? Anyway, it says that that somehow implies that Dearborn will remain a super clean city. Yes, he did become known for his, and this is capital L, capital W, lily white attitude, but that didn't keep him from becoming friends with our neighbors in Inkster. In fact, he performed a marriage ceremony for the mayor of Inkster at one point during the 1950s. He wanted Dearborn residents to enjoy the out-of-doors and developed Camp Dearborn, 35 miles from Dearborn City Hall in Milford, a recreation area which is still enjoyed by many residents and friends today. He's also responsible for developing Dearborn, Florida, in Clearwater. It has been sold, but many residents enjoyed their time in the high-rise close to the Gulf of Mexico. Mayor Hubbard cared for all people and the quality of life. He was never paid the money he was worth in dollars or the many long hours he spent during his career, just the quality of life he established for our former residents many of us will never forget. He was father of five children, four sons and one daughter. Two are still residents of Dearborn, former Councilwoman Nancy A. Hubbard and James Hubbard, a former Dearborn policeman. Since Art Space has taken over Old City Hall at Michigan and Schaefer, I believe the Hubbard statue should be moved from Old City Hall to the Henry Ford Centennial Library grounds. That's the opinion of Gretchen Ackerman of Dearborn. I think the idea last week was that why don't we put it in the Henry Ford Museum or some place indoors with plaques, Dearborn Historical Museum, for example, with information and background so that we can appreciate what he did and what he was at the time and how that mattered or didn't matter to us, how that matters or doesn't matter to us today. At least it could be more than just passing a statue. You know what I'm saying? Passing a statue in a garden. And you know, after a few years, Gretchen, I'm sure you understand, people won't remember what the heck that was or who that was. They won't even bother to look at the plaque. but in a museum somewhere, the statue could still be part of an informative exhibit that would maintain a little better attention from the visitors. Well, we'll see what happens with the city. I'm sure it's another big issue coming up for the Dearborn City Council, as well as whether or not we can smoke tobacco in the city parks. Another big issue there. Let's see. Speaking of big issues, oh my goodness. Here's a prohibition that I wasn't aware of. But with increasing use of commercial fireworks since Michigan's fireworks law changed in 2011, this is, by the way, going to appear in Press and Guide probably this weekend. It was published on their website just yesterday. The article says it's no surprise that Chinese sky lanterns have become more popular across the state. Steve LaFleur, owner of Southgate Fireworks, said, "We sold thousands of sky lanterns for the 4th of July this year. Within the area of driftability to Allen Park or downriver, there's probably north of 100,000 that have been sold and used." Unquote. When lit properly, the balloon-like paper lanterns, usually made of biodegradable rice paper in a bamboo frame with a small candle or fuel cell attached to the bottom, can rise thousands of feet into the air and are designed to fall back down to the ground gently once the fuel is depleted. For many, the lanterns symbolize freedom or hope and are often used to memorialize a lost loved one or to add a unique twist to a special evening or gathering. Southgate resident Rachel Becklick says, "One of my good friends passed away about 2 weeks ago. I lit one off for him at my family's lake house up north. It provided me a great feeling being able to write something on it and watch it float away." Unquote. However, despite their popularity, many downriver cities have taken steps to ban the use of sky lanterns entirely. Some, like Allen Park, going as far as considering banning the sale of sky lanterns as well. Allen Park Fire Chief Doug LaFon said, "We know it's not going to be easily enforceable, but we want to send the message out there that these things are dangerous and you shouldn't be launching them. The opinion from the state fire marshal is that they are considered a novelty and they don't follow the definition of a firework. So they're basically fair game if we want to write an ordinance against them." The Allen Park City, unquote. Allen Park City Council held its first and second reading of the ordinance to ban sky lanterns at its July 14th meeting, deciding later to draft a version that includes the sale of the items in the city. The use of sky lanterns is also prohibited in many other nearby cities, including Dearborn, Melvindale, Lincoln Park, Trenton, Wyandotte, and Taylor. The city of Riverview is working on drafting an ordinance relating to sky lanterns as well. Though the contents of the ordinance have not yet been publicized, Riverview Deputy Fire Chief Michael Poole said, quote, that's the information they got from Riverview Deputy Fire Chief. Another comment, State Representative Frank Liberati, Democrat Allen Park, he says, quote, "I definitely think they're unsafe. There's no question about it." He's currently sponsoring legislation to repeal Michigan's 2011 fireworks law that would include sky lanterns as well. I don't know how anybody could argue they're not if you have a fire in the sky you can't control, especially around the 4th of July. Many downriver residents have reported finding sky lanterns in their yard or on their roof, some while they're still lit. There must have been a tear in the rice paper or something, folks, because they shouldn't come down if it's still lit. But that's definitely a fire hazard, along with fireworks, you have to admit. Even sparklers, folks, are a fire hazard. If you don't dispose of them properly, they will burn paper, straw, whatever they contact if they haven't gone out yet and if they're not cold. I'm just adding that point. I know that's for a fact. 2 years ago, here's a quote from Woodhaven resident Denise Kemp Trader. 2 years ago, we came home from the Woodhaven fireworks to find out what was left of a Chinese lantern burning on my patio a couple of feet from my cloth-top gazebo in my house. I'm thankful it didn't land on the roof or the gazebo, but not happy that they are allowed. And most downriver fire chiefs say that they've not yet had to dispatch a fire personnel to respond to a sky lantern fire. Many believe the simple nature of the lanterns makes them a fire hazard. So there you go. I think the important thing is that you shouldn't do it, legal or not, folks, because they can drift. They can go someplace that you don't intend, and that's not safe. And but it is. Let me go over this again. It looks like Allen Park soon will have banned them, and the cities where they are banned, the use is banned, is Dearborn, Melvindale, Lincoln Park, Trenton, Wyandotte, and Taylor at present. and City of Riverview a little bit down the road on that. So let your elected representatives, whether it's Liberati Frank Liberati in Allen Park, or George Delaney here in Dearborn, let them know how you feel about the Michigan fireworks law. Again, it was passed by a Republican majority, supposedly because it's good for business. Yay! But if it's a public health hazard, a safety hazard, then, well, those aren't the kind of businesses we want to be supporting. Someone out there is saying, well, you just can't be too careful. You can't have laws against everything. There's a threat of prohibition and everything. Yeah, I know. Driving cars is dangerous. Drinking alcohol is dangerous, whether you're driving cars with it, alcohol or not. There's all kinds of dangers in the world constantly. Most of the time we go through life blissfully, unaware, usually by choice, but sometimes by stupidity, ignorance. Okay, not stupidity, ignorance. But we got to get things done, right? We have to live a life, and we try to enjoy it. And if you don't think it through, it's a problem. Well, here's something that was fun years ago. Bobble boat St. Clair could be scrapped unless new dock location is found. This is from Jim Kasuba, and this is also another downriver story, because the Bobble boat St. Clair has been docked. It's 105 years old. And it is served as a venue for the moonlight cruises to Bablo, when Bablo Island actually was an amusement park. And it holds up to 2,400 passengers at one time. A person that owned the boat since 2007 originally expected it to be restored by now, but hasn't been able to get that accomplished. Well, now the boat is at the U.S. Steel Dock in Ecorse, and they've got to move the boat, because there's construction going to be done on the shoreline, and he doesn't have any spot for it. He may have no option but to scrap the boat. And that'll be the end of its life, and there you go. The other boat, which is a Bablo boat, interestingly, has been bought and moved to a location in New York State and is in use, of all things. There's a possibility it could go down to Toledo and maybe another location, Ohio, but that would be too far to suit the owner's purposes. He said he wants it to stay somewhere nearby. Yeah, but what you going to do with it? There is no Bablo no more. But that's a moment from the past, and we feel sorry about that. Final note here, and we're going to end early with a few songs from the Spinners. Yeah, the Spinners. Going to be at Dearborn Homecoming on Saturday night, August 8th. Free performance at 8 p.m. But before homecoming, the public is invited to an August 4th open house of the Dearborn Administrative Center, also known as the New City Hall. And also you can enjoy free refreshments and entertainment, because the police department is doing what's called a national night out on crime. It doesn't mean a night out to do crime, but to prevent crime. Okay, so free hot dogs, chips, and ice cream, all that unhealthy stuff, contests, music, things to distract you from looking at the new City Hall. Did I say that? Well, apparently, the details show here is that you're invited to enter the new City Hall, tour the public areas of the first floor, not the second floor. No one knows what's going on up there. It might be unsafe. Who knows? Because no one is allowed to go in there. And you can even walk into the city council chambers. Ooh, it's a multi-purpose room with a bunch of chairs in it, folks. Don't get awe-inspired. It's not like the old one. You can pick up city information. They'll have brochures on a table. You can enjoy light refreshments and try out the kiosk at the customer service desk at the main entrance. That means a computer terminal. When you hoped when you walked in the main entrance, somebody's going to talk to you. No, you get a kiosk. You get a computer in your face. That's the way of the world these days. Nonetheless, it is going to happen. Last time it didn't happen, because I was there and the door was closed. It was locked up tight because they changed their minds at the last minute and didn't promote it, of course. Anyway, even though it was on the city website calendar. This time it is scheduled for Tuesday, August 4th from 5 to 8. And in the parking lot, oh my gosh, you're going to have the police vehicles, the SWAT team, the bomb squad, the police bicycle patrol, and the canine unit too. So just in case somebody wants to do something nasty to the city hall, because they're going to open it to the public, they'll have a lot of backup there escort that person out. Yep. It's just very strange that they decided to do it that way. Why not focus all on the city hall? Is there not enough to show, or not enough you're willing to show? I have to ask these tough questions. It's my job. Okay. Got to read between the lines. That's what we do. Thank you for listening. And this is WHFR Dearborn. And we're going to feature a couple songs by Spinners and Highway 61. The Best in the Blues is going to start today with a few songs that are Zydeco. Yeah, because I'm the one that's programming it right now. Joanne will be here in just a few minutes to take you until 6 p.m. tonight. Thank you for listening to the new WHFR Journal, and tune in again next week from 1 to 2 p.m. or on the website anytime, whfr.fm. Click on Talk Shows, WHFR Journal, and select the date you want. Bye for now. Take care out there.
been paying every day.
I want.